Okay, so I'd like to dedicate the talk this evening for a friend of mine and a friend of some of the people here I know as well, somebody who has been staying in Perth for some of the time in the past year or so, and he's going through an extremely difficult period at the moment. So somebody, I'm not sure if you're out there and listening, but if you are, then you know that our thoughts are with you. And I'm sure whatever dukkha you're having will come to an end sometime. So for the talk this evening, I'm going to talk about... See, normally I don't prepare my talks beforehand, so I have no idea what I'm going to say, right? And I developed this practice when I first started giving Dhamma talks, that I would never give a Dhamma talk on anything that I'd thought about beforehand. Right? So if I'd thought about like the Eightfold Path, then I couldn't give a talk about the Eightfold Path. If I thought about the Four Noble Truths, I couldn't give a talk about the Four Noble Truths. And that was really good. That really kind of cut off any proliferation. So I got quite used to sitting there at the beginning of the Dhamma talk and saying, well, now I'm going to talk about... and not having any idea what was going to come out of my mouth. Anyway, but tonight, unfortunately, I'm not going to do that. So tonight I did have an idea what I was going to talk about. And what I'm going to talk about is a book which Venerable Brahmali and myself have recently completed and which has just been published. And the book's called The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Texts. And it probably sounds like a very dry and boring title to a very dry and boring book. And you're quite right, it is a very dry and boring book. So if you want fun stories, get Ajahn Brahm's books. If you want dry and boring, get mine. Anyway, I'll try to give a talk about it this evening that's not going to be quite so dry and boring, okay? But anyway, what's the book about and what did we write it for and so on? It's recently been published. It's been published through the Oxford Centre for Buddhist Studies. So this is one of the other reasons why I wanted to mention it tonight, because I'm very proud that we've got something published through Oxford, right? I mean, I used to be a dirty, smelly hippie, okay? I played guitar and had long hair and all of that kind of stuff. And now I'm a part of the establishment. I've been, my mum can finally be proud of me after all these years. So, what's the book about? What are we doing? Why was it interesting? Well, first of all, the notion of authenticity. What's authenticity mean, right? The real thing, yeah? Coke is the real thing, so that's authentic, so that's sorted. Okay. Does that mean Pepsi isn't the real thing? So we have this kind of idea that kind of something that's real is good and something that's fake is no good, right? But it's one of those ideas which is kind of... It's a bit hard to know exactly why that's the case when you start to look at it, isn't it? Right? I mean, there's a website, for example, which is a very very actually a very well done one and very informative, called Fake Buddha Quotes. Yeah. So if you're not familiar with that, Fake Buddha Quotes is one of my favourite Buddhist websites. It's right up there with BuddhismandVampires.com. You think I'm kidding, right? Yeah, but you're gonna check it out when you go home, right? BuddhismandVampires.com, it's a real thing, yeah. Of course, it's all about this kind of tantric non-duality kind of stuff, but I mentioned it once, so we were sitting around with Ajahn Brahm and some of the Theravadan monks. So from like a Tibetan perspective, you know, they're all interested in this kind of the, you know, life and death and all of these kinds of things. But from the Theravadins, as soon as they heard about vampires, they said, well, if a vampire was a monk, would they be able to drink blood in the afternoon? That was that was the number one problem that we had with the whole thing. Anyway, so fakebuddhaquotes.com. It was very interesting, actually, because it takes out all of these things, which, you know, it's attributed to the Buddha, right? The Buddha said this and the Buddha said that and so on. But he does a very good job, because he doesn't just... say, well, whether the Buddha said it or not, but he actually traces it back and finds out who used it and what context they used it and how it kind of evolved. And of course, usually you find out. One of the interesting things is that many of the quotes on that site are actually quite nice, right? So it's not the case that because maybe it's a fake quote that therefore there's something wrong with it. Actually, many of the things that's quoted are very beautiful, right? And so the fact that something might be inauthentic doesn't mean that it's wrong, it doesn't mean that it's bad and so on, but still we have a kind of a sense of what something means to be authentic, and we find some kind of resonance with that. I mean, for me, I felt that very much when I went to Thailand and I started, you know, my Buddhist practice. I mean, before that I hadn't really had any interest in spirituality. I mean, I'd been brought up as a Catholic, but then when I was a teenager I decided that God didn't exist, and so the whole tradition was a bit meaningless to me after that. I had no real interest in it. You know, and then there's various kinds of kind of New Age spirituality and, I don't know, crystals and dolphins and stuff, and it all just kind of passed me by. I never felt that there was anything really meaningful about it. But when I went to Thailand and I, you know, wanted to practice meditation, again, it wasn't because I was Buddhist or anything like that. Really, it was just because it was the cheapest place to stay, actually. And it's true. Anyway, oh, well, might as well, whatever, I'll do this meditation stuff. And one of the things that actually really impressed me about that retreat, I did it at this monastery called Wat Rampung in Chiang Mai, but they didn't try to convince me of anything. Right? They didn't try to sell me anything. They basically just told me how to meditate. You sit down, sit like this, blah, 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 this is the meditation instructions, just do that. And so I went away and I did, you know, started out like 15 minutes of meditation. I'm like, what is this? This is rubbish. It's not... Okay, I'll try another one. I'll see whether that's going anywhere. So, you know, gradually went into it and had an amazing experience on that retreat. And I think that was one of the things that convinced me something about that, that there was something authentic in that tradition, was that there wasn't a defensiveness about it, right? Often when it comes to religion and spirituality, there's this kind of feeling that, you know, I'm kind of right and I have to make you believe the same things that I do, right? I find this is a terrifying mindset, right? Imagine what the world would be like if you actually made everybody in the world believe the same things that you do. What a horrific world that would be in. It'd be incredibly boring. Yeah, a couple of months ago, I was catching a train from Perth back down to Serpentine, and I was sitting at the train station minding my business, and this lady comes up to me and says, "Oh, hi." I said, "Oh, hello." She said, "Have you heard of the word of Jesus?" Oh, that's fascinating. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the light. Oh, really, is he? Oh, yes, yes, what Jesus says is the truth, yes. What the Muslims say is a lie. Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. Here's these websites, you should check these out. Oh, thank you, that's very kind. Oh, whoops, I've got a train to catch, excuse me. So I'm lining up to get on the train. Oh, she comes up and she's lining up behind me, and she's saying, "Oh, well, and I've got this." Look, I said, please. "I've listened to what you said, that's enough." She kept on trying more and more. I said, please, "I've listened to what you said, that's enough." So eventually she quietened down. We get on the train, I sit down, there's an empty seat next to me. No, I mean, we've got seat numbers, we've got tickets, right? So it's not like random or anything. "Oh, look," she says, "oh, I've got the seat next to you." I was very lucky because I'd downloaded a recent paper by Roger Penrose on quantum consciousness, so I could sit there and read that book on quantum physics and consciousness and kind of dry my brain out. It was a kind of excellent antidote to this kind of thing. But isn't this weird, isn't it? When you stop and you think about it, why we feel this compulsion to make other people believe the same thing that we do, right? As if we have all the answers and so on. And obviously underlying that is a very deep sense of insecurity, right? There's a deep sense of, I don't know, fear, or, you know, you need your beliefs to be reinforced. It's a bit sad and it's a bit childish. And so my experience when I came to Buddhism, certainly at that first monastery that I was at, nobody was trying to persuade me anything. Actually, nobody taught me anything. The whole retreat we did, nearly a month, there wasn't any Dhamma talks. There's one short Dhamma talk in the middle of the retreat and that was it. Basically, they just told you how to meditate, go away and meditate. And when you came back and you told them your experiences, they say, "Okay, that's fine, go away and do some more meditation." And, you know, they were there to guide you and support you, but they weren't there to tell you what to experience or what it meant, right? You had to find that out for yourself. And so to me, there was something very powerful and very profound in that. So afterwards, I wanted to practice more and so on. I wandered around Thailand, did various kinds of things, and I ended up at Wat Nanachat, which is the forest monastery in the Ajahn Chah tradition for the English-speaking monks. And again, you know, what I found there was something which felt to me very authentic. It felt to me like pretty much, I mean, none of these things are 100%, but pretty much it felt to me like what the community there was doing was looking, well, what did the Buddha say to do? How did the Buddha say to live? And let's just do that, rather than apologizing and interpreting your way out of things and trying to make excuses and to say, look, we'll try our best to do everything as much as we could, as much as the Buddha said, and to live that monastic life as the Buddha laid down. And I found that very inspiring and very, very fulfilling. So there's some intuition or some connection we feel with this idea of something being authentic. It's the real thing. And I don't know that we can ever kind of fully explain that or fully articulate it. But certainly within the sphere of Buddhism, you know, if we say, okay, we're Buddhists, we're following the Buddhist path, we're following this is the Buddhist teachings and so on and so forth, well, should we not have some idea of who the Buddha was, what he taught? I mean, it would seem to be fairly obvious that that would be part of being a Buddhist, right? I mean, I'm brought up as a Catholic and every Sunday in the Catholic Church, they'll sort of read out from the Gospels and read the word of Jesus. And so if you're supposed to be a Christian, you should know what it is that Christ actually said. Surely it should be the same in Buddhism, but actually it's not really quite the same. And what you find in Buddhism, most forms of Buddhism in most places, is that people have a, I think, shockingly little understanding of what the Buddha actually taught. And moreover, I think that we as a community, we are very proud of ourselves for being rational, scientific. All of these things which you'll read about, countless books about Buddhism will say Buddhism's all about experience, it's about investigation, it's about finding out the truth for yourself and all of these kinds of things. And yet I believe that we're negligent and afraid to apply those principles to our own tradition and to accept what are the consequences of them. So for me, it's always been very important to have this attitude of saying, well, look, if this is real, okay, if the Dhamma is real, if Buddhism is real, then it doesn't care about what I do to it, right? I can test it any way I want. I can analyze it any way I want. I can question it any way I want. And the Dhamma, if the Dhamma is really true, it should be able to stand up to the most rigorous kind of testing that I can do. The same thing as you think in science, right? If it's really a scientific law, you should be able to test it any way you like and you come up with the same results. So if the Dhamma is real, it's real. So, of course, well, what is the Dhamma? Well, basic Dhamma, the Buddha taught, Four Noble Truths. Right? What are the Four Noble Truths? Well, basically that there's suffering. Okay. So I think that's pretty real, right? That's pretty authentic. We've all suffered, right? We've all got sick. We've all felt grief. We've all felt pain. So that's all right. We can test that. The origin of suffering. Origin of suffering is a little bit more subtle, but the basic idea, the origin of suffering is that the suffering in the meaningful sense is something that we produce from inside ourselves. Right? It's not to say there aren't external forms of suffering as well. Obviously there are, right? Sometimes we can control those, sometimes we can't. But the inner suffering, the real suffering, is something that we can control or we can change. And that always comes back to us. So in that sense, the Buddha's teachings is always extremely empowering. It's not about finding some validation or some savior or anything like that. It's about finding the truth within yourself. So if the origin of suffering is within yourself, then the reality is that the ending of suffering is also within yourself, the ending of greed, ending of hatred, the ending of delusion. And not only have we felt that suffering, we've also felt the origin of suffering, we've also all felt the ending of that suffering. We felt that moment when we were able to let go of anger. Right? and you knew that when you let go of that anger and you felt forgiveness and you felt love, wasn't that the ending of suffering? That moment when you were so confused and so full of doubts and uncertainties, and then there was a moment of clarity, wisdom arose. You saw, oh, that's what I need to do. That's what the answer is. Yeah? That's the ending of suffering. This is the third noble truth. And the last four noble truths is the way of practice, the Eightfold Path, leading to the ending of suffering. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. And you should all know what those eight factors are. Okay, if you don't, go away and learn them and practice them. Anyway, I'm not going to give a talk all about the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths today because that would take a whole talk. But anyway, so my point here is simply that when we look at the Dhamma, we can see that the things that the Buddha talked about are real. Okay, the basic teachings, the things that the Buddha himself said were the most important and the central part of his teaching, that there's something that's real, there's something that you can experience. You don't have to take it on my authority or on Ajahn Brahm's authority or on anybody else's authority, not because you read it in the suttas or anything like that. You know it because you see it for yourself. And to me, that's the ultimate badge of authenticity, is something where you can actually see and have that experience for yourself. And in fact, the Buddha cautioned against being too reliant on a textual tradition. In the Sandaka Sutta, he said that if you live the holy life dependent on a textual tradition, right, faith in a textual tradition, then that is dubious. Why? Well, because sometimes texts might be wrong and sometimes they're right. Sometimes they may be remembered well, sometimes they're remembered badly. Sometimes they might be passed down accurately, sometimes they're passed down inaccurately. Yeah? And so if your spiritual life is dependent on faith in a particular scripture, then you don't have a solid foundation. The only real solid foundation for our Dhamma practice is our own experience. Right? Having said which, right, experience is complex, right? Experience is confusing, and experience doesn't always tell us the same thing. And we do have delusion in our hearts, and because we have delusion in our hearts, we see things the wrong way sometimes, right? And so it's very helpful to have a guide who can, you know, direct us in the right way. Yeah? And so the Buddha said that right view arises from two sources. One is that inner reflection, yonisa manasikara, and the other is from the voice of another, paratoghosa. Yeah? So the voice of another. As long as we're still in ignorance, in delusion, then it's helpful to have a guide. Right? So the best guide of all, I think, is the Buddha. And so I think it's important to look, what did the Buddha teach? Why did he teach in that way? And to take that seriously and to look at that carefully and to really try to understand that. Now, when you begin to do that, then you immediately run into problems. As I mentioned with the Fake Buddha Quotes website, that, well, there's lots of people saying the Buddha said all kinds of things. How do we sift this out? How do we know what the Buddha said and what the Buddha didn't say? Well, the Buddhist tradition is quite, loose in its claims of authenticity. There are many scriptures, some of them written hundreds of years after the Buddha, sometimes thousands of years after the Buddha, which people will, in some sense, say are authentic or were taught by the Buddha. So we can't rely on what the traditions say in this particular respect. Every tradition will tell you that their own texts are authentic, and you know, in a sense, if they're helping people to overcome suffering and so on, then that's fine. But it doesn't really help us to get to the nitty-gritty of what it is that the Buddha taught. So this question of how do we discern what it is the Buddha taught and distinguish it is something which we find addressed in every strata of Buddhist history, from the early texts, from the suttas themselves, through to the teachings in different histories, chronicles, discussions, commentaries, and so on, through the ages. And this is discussed, and we find discussions in Indian texts, in Sri Lankan texts, in Tibetan texts, in Chinese texts. And so it was something which was part of what it meant to be a part of the Buddhist community, was to think, to try how to figure this out. In modern times, that discussion was taken up initially primarily by Western scholars, and they applied some of the techniques and ideas that have been developed in Western scholarship to the Buddhist texts. These ideas were originally developed when doing Bible studies, where there are some similar kinds of ideas. And when this work was done originally, and this was in the mid to late 19th century, there came to be a more or less a scholarly consensus about what was early, what was late, what texts could be meaningfully attributed to the Buddha, what texts could not be meaningfully attributed to the Buddha, and what was the historical process by which that evolved. And to summarise a complex matter much too simply, the four Nikayas of the Pali Canon and some of the parts of the fifth Nikaya, the Kuddhika Nikaya, are often usually regarded as being the earliest parts of the Buddhist scriptures. The Vinaya Pitaka, the discipline for monks and nuns, has early portions, mainly the rules of Parimokkha, but most of the rest of it is somewhat later, maybe 100, 200, 300 years after the Buddha. And the Abhidhamma Pitaka and some of the other books in the Kuddhika were obviously composed 200, 300, or 400 years after the Buddha. Mahayana scriptures are, of course, composed later still, from 400 to 500 years up to 1,000 years after the Buddha and even later. And so this was a rough working consensus on the history of the Buddhist scriptures, which was worked out in the mid to late 19th century by a series of scholars, Max Müller, Hermann Oldenburg, Thomas Rhys-Davids and others, and which kind of still provides really the framework which we use to look at the history of Buddhism and the history of Buddhist texts. Over the 20th century, that framework was questioned, it was modified and nuanced, and many of the stronger claims which were made by the earlier scholars came to be questioned or presented in a more cautious form later on, as often happens in scholarly circles. So one example of that would be, say, what is the language which the Buddha taught? And the early generations of scholars said that the Buddha taught Pali, which of course is the claim of the Theravadin school. But later on, discovered the edicts of King Ashoka, which are found in a language which is very similar to Pali, but not quite the same. And so through study of those texts and other things, they came to understand that the Buddha didn't quite speak Pali. He spoke something pretty much similar to Pali, but probably a slightly different dialect. And we don't know exactly what dialect he would have spoken, or quite likely, actually, dialects. I think it's likely that he would have spoken with a slightly different accent in different parts of the country as he travelled around. This is still something you see which is very common in many countries today. I remember when I was in Malaysia that the monks would sometimes, before they give a Dhamma talk, they would ask people, you know, how many people speak English, how many speak Hokkien, how many people speak Mandarin, and they sort of find out what the majority is, and they'd give a Dhamma talk in that particular language. So I suspect the Buddha would have given talks in various dialects. Anyway, so later, you know, the scholarly consensus these days is the Buddha spoke something close to Pali, but probably not identical with it. Right? And so there's been these kind of changes and adaptations and development of these ideas over the years. But this ideas was very strongly challenged starting from the 1980s by a series of scholars, most influential of which is Gregory Chopin, who basically threw out the idea that we can consider any Buddhist text to be authentic. They said we haven't really got any basis on which to say that the Pali Canon was spoken by the Buddha, and everything that people have said about what early Buddhism is sheer speculation. And that view, which I think is nonsense, has become more or less the standard or de facto orthodoxy in many circles in modern academia, especially in American Buddhism. It's a view which has gained little traction among people who specialize in Pali and early Buddhist studies. Most of those scholars will reject those views. But the people who specialise in later forms of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism and so on, tend to dismiss the authenticity of the early Buddhist texts, and this has become very, very influential. So, and as these things go, these views don't remain just among the academics, but they also filter down into the general population, and so you find a strong, you know, discussions and strands among people who are interested in secular Buddhism and other kinds of things, and it often gets kind of said almost off the cuff. We can't know what the Buddha taught, or we haven't got any basis for saying the Pali Canon was early or anything like that. And so it's almost as if this conversation has been completed, and any rational person would know that we haven't got any basis for thinking that these texts are authentic. Now, I find this a little bit silly. And obviously, I think it's a meaningful question, right? Now, let's assume for a moment that this argument is correct, and let's assume that we haven't got any reason for saying that what the Buddha taught in the suttas was authentic. Does that make any difference? Right? Well, in one sense, I don't know. In one sense, it doesn't really make a difference. I mean, we still have the teachings, don't we? Right? You still have the Four Noble Truths. You still suffer. Yeah? And we can still experience it. We can still experience meditation and so on, and that's an authentic experience. So in one sense, it doesn't actually matter all that much. Yeah? But on the other hand, it kind of also does matter, doesn't it? I think it matters, or it matters to me anyway. I find something very powerful and very nourishing in the idea that we actually have a connection with this font of wisdom, this incredible, innovative, insightful man that we call the Buddha. And when I read the suttas, I'm constantly struck at how powerful and effortless the wisdom is that the Buddha brings to the table. You know, when I read other philosophers and other writers and spiritual leaders and so on, and you can always find that there's some truth there. You can find there's some insight, some understanding and so on. But it always feels like much more of a struggle, that it's very kind of difficult, bits and pieces of wisdom mixed with a lot of other things. Whereas with the Buddha, to me, anyway, it's just my response, but I feel that he just kind of swept everything away and just laid it out and said, actually, this is what it is, this is where we're at, this is what we need to do. And I get a sense of clarity and purpose from the suttas that I don't find in anything else. And so this, I think, for me is why, you know, the suttas have this kind of ring of authenticity. They feel like there's something that comes from a genuine, deep sense of spiritual realization. So what we find in Buddhist circles, sometimes in academic discussions and so on, is that the study of the early Buddhist texts has largely been neglected. In fact, in my own experience, I've been to a conference on Buddhist studies, and I gave a paper there. It was a two-day conference. There was papers presented every 20 minutes for 2 days. Right? It's quite a lot of papers, right? And in that 2 days, only one paper talked about anything that happened in the first 500 years of Buddhism. And that was mine. Okay? The rest of the papers, no one said anything about the suttas, about the Vinaya, about King Ashoka, about early Buddhism, about the early Buddhist schools, nothing. It was just not in the curriculum. There's not anything anybody spoke about, right? And that's not unusual, okay? So I think this is wrong. I think it was crazy. I can't imagine that you'd go to a conference on Christianity and have nobody mention anything that happened in the Bible, right? You go to a conference on Islam and have the Quran is off the table. I mean, I find this is ridiculous. Of course, we have to study these things, learn them, find out about them, and find what meaning they have for us, find what meaning they have for our lives. So, as Ajahn Brahmali and myself, about a year ago, a bit over a year ago, we'd sit and have cups of tea and we'd rant about how terrible all this is and blah, blah, blah. And then we thought, okay, well, we'll do something about it. So we decided, well, we'll write this book. So one of the things that we had, one of the thoughts we had about this was that the reason why these skeptical ideas, these excessively skeptical ideas, have got such traction, I think, is because I think it's because a lot of people don't know the facts. And the reason that people don't know the facts is because no one's actually got them all together, because all of the different arguments and evidences and reasons are scattered here and there in articles and essays and books and papers and so on over the last 150 years, right? And almost, you know, you can read dozens of books and so on which all mention kind of one reason here and there and bits and pieces of it, of evidence and ideas, but there's nowhere that brings it all together in one place. So this is our idea, was to bring it all together in one place, give the references, and we present all of the ideas just in brief. So it's something like a kind of a reference. You know, if you're interested in these kinds of questions and somebody says to you, oh, you know, we know that the Buddha didn't teach the suttas because he didn't speak the same language, you know, Pali was a later language, then you can say, okay, is that right or is that wrong? And then there'll be a section in the book that will discuss that point, and you can look at that and it'll give references. So it's just something which is meant to be useful in that way. It's not going to, you know, solve your spiritual crises for you, but it may, you know, hopefully be something that can give you some information that might be helpful from time to time. So one of the problems here is that there's no magic bullet, right? There's no kind of Rosetta Stone or something like that, right? There's no, we don't have any suttas. It'd be lovely to have a sutta carved in stone that's 2,500 years old or something like that. In one of the commentary stories in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, it talks about how King Pasenadi made a gift for another king, Pukkasati, and he, as a gift, he thought, what's the most valuable thing in my realm? And he thought, oh, well, the Dhamma is the most valuable thing in my realm. So he carved in gold plates all of these suttas, right? Had them carved down and made them, sent them as a gift for King Pukkasati. Now, we don't know whether that actually happened, but if it did, then that would be great, wouldn't it? And if they still existed, we could pull them out, we could say, hey, these are some suttas from the time of the Buddha, therefore, and we read them and go, oh my God, we were wrong all along. Actually, that's what happened in that's what happened in Confucianism. I don't know if you know, but in Chinese history, there was one similar thing happened, about 500 or 600 years, something after Confucius had died, they demolished his house and they found all these papers which he had written, and they unfortunately contradicted a lot of things which the Confucianists were saying, which is kind of a bit embarrassing. So then they kind of split and have two schools. So maybe that's what would happen. But anyway, hasn't happened in Buddhism so far. Right, so we don't have any one piece of evidence. And so this is the kind of argument which the skeptics will say, oh, there's no manuscripts from that time. Right, there's no, you know, so they sort of insist that you have to have sort of one particular kind of evidence. But the problem is that the actual reasons for believing in that the suttas stem mainly from the time of the Buddha is not because of any one particular piece of evidence. It's because of countless small pieces of evidence, no one of which is decisive, right, and all of which might be interpreted another way, right? But when you take them all together, the simplest, most persuasive, most powerful explanation for it is simply that these texts were largely spoken by a spiritual teacher known as the Buddha, who lived in ancient India around the 5th century BC, and that it was remembered and passed down by his community, later date, put into writing, and so on and so forth. And so that hypothesis on the origin of the suttas is, I think, a reasonable one. It doesn't involve any kind of magical or, you know, things. It doesn't involve any imposition of ideas that anything that we don't know and experience. It's a perfectly empirical theory, and it's quite a simple one. And I think it explains a whole lot of facts. So, when I'm mentioned about these different kinds of evidence and so on, well, what kinds of things am I talking about? Well, you'll have to get the book and read it to find out about all of those things, but I'll just mention one or two things that give you some idea of the kinds of details which we find in the early suttas which tend to give it a clear location in time and place. Okay. One of those, and I think perhaps the most powerful single piece of evidence, is about the politics of the time. Now, the Buddha during the suttas, you know, it's entirely taken for granted that the Buddha was wandering from country to country, Right? We read this all the time in the suttas. The Buddha wandered from Rajagaha, and then he went to Sarvati, and then he went to Vaisali, and they had different governments in different places. They had different kings and so on and so forth. So there were these different nations, and those different nations are sometimes called the 16 great states, 16 Mahajanapada. Now, the boundaries of those nations were fluid, they were contested, they changed during the Buddha's lifetime, so it was a fluid situation. Right? But one thing which we often don't realize and don't understand is that political situation was completely changed in ancient India within a couple of generations of the Buddha's death. Okay, so between about 50, maybe 60, 70, 80 years after the Buddha died, that situation was completely different. And we know that based on very strong historical evidence. The difference was that the 16 nations had vanished and they were replaced by one empire, which was the empire of the Nandas. So in Buddhist history, we're often very familiar with King Ashoka, who played a very powerful role in spreading Buddhism. But the empire which Ashoka ruled was built on the empire of the Nandas. Now, the Nandas lived, we don't know much about them, but they lived 50, 60, 70 years after the Buddha. And we know something about the extent of their empire. We know that because, firstly, Alexander turned back at the mere rumour of the Nandas and their strength. Okay, so those of you who know your Greek history will know that Alexander the Great invaded India a bit less than 100 years after the Buddha passed away. And when they reached a point in northwestern India, which is somewhat north to the north and west of Delhi today. And there he and his men heard the rumours of the Nanda Empire and of their military might, and especially their war elephants. And at that, Alexander's men rebelled and they refused to march any further, and that was the end of Alexander's conquests. So that places the Nanda Empire to the far northwest of India, past Delhi. So we have a limit up that way. We also have a limit to the southeast because there's an inscription found dated from a little bit after that period that talks about an irrigation work which had been accomplished by the king of the Nandas in that area, and that's in Andhra Pradesh. Oh, sorry, not in Andhra Pradesh, in Kalinga, in Kalinga. So we know that the Nandas were in Kalinga, and they didn't just wander through, but they were actually doing capital works there. They were making irrigation. So we have very good historical reasons to know that the Nandas Empire, about 50 years or so after the Buddha, stretched from Kalinga on the southeast coast of India all the way to the northwest, about as far as Pakistan, and completely replaced the old 16 Mahajanapadas. Now, the essential point here is that in all of the suttas, there is no mention of that. Okay. There's no hint of that kind of realm which crossed the whole kind of India as a historical reality. It's completely taken for granted throughout millions of words of texts that there are these different countries that the Buddha's wandering through, and that's the environment. Okay, and so it's, to me, in my mind, it's completely impossible to kind of fabricate that, to kind of invent that kind of world, and to not have any hint of that later state of affairs. And we know that in later times, when Buddhists did try to invent texts that historically placed them in the time of the Buddha, that they got many things wrong. They were very bad at inventing history, okay? Probably because they didn't care about it all that much. So the fact that these 16 Mahajanapadas are mentioned all the way through the suttas, and yet they vanished within a few decades of the Buddha passing away, I think this is one of the strong reasons for thinking that the suttas stem from the time of the Buddha, and that there was little modification to them in later times. So this is just one argument, and in the book we mention dozens of similar arguments from different points of view. And like I said, with each one, then of course it might be wrong, it might be right, might be persuasive or less persuasive, but the argument as a whole comes from taking everything and looking at it as one, and then seeing, well, what kind of story, what kind of way of seeing this is going to make the most sense, is going to be the most simplest and most straightforward. So this is the kind of thing which we're doing with this book on the authenticity of the Buddhist texts, and my hope is that by doing it, we provide some support and some encouragement for people to practice what's found in those texts. Why? Well, because I think it's better. I mean, I make a value judgment on these things. Right? I'm a monk. I'm allowed to make value judgments. It's okay. You know, there's a thoroughgoing suppression of the suttas in Buddhism. I don't know if you ever noticed. But almost every school, almost every movement in Buddhism has a strong vested interest in stopping people from reading the suttas. This is why if you go to almost every Buddhist monastery, we laugh about this, but it's true. Most Buddhist monasteries you go to, the Tripitaka will be in a cabinet on the shrine which is locked and you can't find anyone who has the key, right? And this is, we kind of joke about this. I saw it again just the other day. I was in a monastery in Thailand and we went around, we found the Tripitaka. It was covered in cobwebs and locked up in a cabinet where nobody can read it, right? Why is this? Well, you can look around. Everyone has something different, right? The Mahayanists have a problem because obviously Mahayana sutras are written much later than the Buddha. The Vipassana schools have a problem because they say you don't need to do jhanas, but the suttas are full of jhanas. The Abhidhamma people have a problem because they think that the Abhidhamma was spoken by the Buddha, and obviously it wasn't. The traditional Buddhism is challenged because, you know, traditional Buddhism is all about rituals and bowing and all of the pujas and so on and so forth, none of which we actually find in the suttas. Well, you find bowing is found in the suttas, but as a sort of cultural way of paying respect, but all the kind of rituals and all of those kinds of things we don't find. And the forest tradition also is very deeply challenged by what's in the suttas because the forest tradition is based on the authority of the Ajahns. Right? What the Ajahn says is true. If you say something else, you're wrong. And, of course, what they say is not always the same as what the suttas say. And this is the forest Ajahns themselves will say this quite explicitly. And they'll quite normal to find them acknowledge this is a forest teaching. It's not the same as what you find in the suttas. So all of these different schools and aspects of Buddhism, and there are many others I could mention, but they're all kind of challenged by the teachings that you find in the suttas. It always makes them a bit uncomfortable. And that's a good thing. And spiritual traditions need to be challenged. And this is one of the great purposes of these scriptures, because they are, in a sense, they're fixed. They're like a fixed point of reference. And even though the text itself is fixed and stays the same, but the way we relate to that is always changing, right? The ideas we bring to it, the methods we bring to it are always changing, right? And what we draw out of it is always changing, right? A fixed collection is not a fixed meaning, right? There's 2 million words in the Pali Canon alone, not to mention the Chinese text, the Sanskrit text, the Tibetan text and so on, which are all part of the early Buddhist corpus. Who can read that stuff? I haven't read all of it. I don't think anybody alive has read all of that. So it's not just what's there, but it's also what do we choose to read, right? What books do we actually pick up and open? It has meaning. What do we make of that? How do we apply it? How do we understand it? All of these things are important. And so I think it's crucial that in the Buddhist tradition that this corpus, these scriptures are always there to challenge us. They're always there to make us not be complacent about what it is that we're doing, to give us another perspective, another point of view, right? Now, this is not to say that all of these other traditions and things are wrong. Right? In fact, when you can understand the history, understand the suttas, where they come from, how they grew, how they changed and so on, then you can appreciate what the traditions are, because every Buddhist tradition is nothing more than a generation of Buddhists who are trying to practice the Dhamma in their own way, in their own time and their own place, responding to the Dhamma and bringing what they can and trying to draw out from the Dhamma. And so there's no surprise if we find out that what Buddhist traditions do, and in fact, of course, what you and I do, right, is only a part of the Dhamma, okay? I mean, the wisdom that I have is a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the wisdom that the Buddha had. The wisdom that you have is a tiny fraction of the wisdom that the Buddha had, right? And so we all can understand those little bits, and we think those little bits are so important. And so, you know, we amplify that and practice that and so on. But the wisdom that the Buddha himself had is so vast. Yeah? And so when we understand this, and we can get some impression of the depth and the breadth of what is offered by the Buddha, then we can begin to see how each tradition is drawing on a particular aspect of what the Buddha taught. Yeah? And so we can see, oh, the Mahayana traditions are drawing on those emphasis on compassion and loving kindness and that kind of breadth of love for all beings. And so this is actually very beautiful. Yeah? And they say the Abhidhamma traditions are drawing on that analytical, rational, very careful way of understanding things. Yeah? There's actually something that's very, very beautiful there. And yeah? The Vipassana traditions are drawing on their practice of mindfulness and of the kind of bare awareness and clarity, which is also something we find in the suttas. And we can find that every tradition of Buddhism is drawing on different aspects of what we find in the suttas. Yeah? And so again, we find that it's not that what the traditions are doing is wrong or anything like that, but just that we can have a broader understanding of the Dhamma. And so we can see how each of those traditions draws on the Dhamma, and we can have some, we're not confused, we're not saying is this right or is that wrong or something like that, but we can see, oh okay, there's this whole context, this whole context of meaning, and we can make sense of where all these things are coming from and why they're all presented as being part of the Dhamma, even though on the surface of it sometimes it looks as if they're very far apart. So this to me is what I would like to see. I'd like to see in the Buddhist community people reading the suttas more, discussing it, taking them seriously. I don't want to see people becoming kind of fundamentalist about it, right? I mean, there's the kind of early Buddhist fundamentalism out there, which is also, I think, a bit silly. I think we need to value what the traditions have done and to appreciate the fact that traditions have passed down the Dhamma to us. And, you know, I think that's an amazing thing. But we need to also remember that traditions only have meaning if they're living, and living things are not static. Static things are fossils, right? Traditions should not be fossils. They need to be living, and that means that they're changing and they're growing. So, and I'm not trying to suggest that I'm not trying to suggest that reading the suttas is the most important thing or anything like that. The most important thing is your own experience of Dhamma. Understanding suffering, being able to let go of it, and practice of the Eightfold Path, especially meditation, that's going to help you to overcome that suffering. That's the most important thing. But reading the suttas is going to help with that, and it will help you develop your right view, it will help you to understand the Eightfold Path, it will give you a sense of connection with the Buddha, and it will give you wisdom and the confidence to be able to practice, to answer questions for yourself, and to be able to grow in the Dhamma. So this is kind of the reasons why we did this book, and this is what we're hoping to promote. So anyway, if you're interested in the book Authenticity of Early Buddhist Texts, so this Dhamma talk is really just one long ad for that book, then you can go to the Oxford Centre for Buddhist Studies site, and you can find the book on that site. I think it's under, there's a link, so something like Academic Studies or something like that, and there's a download thing there, so you can download the PDF. So it's the Oxford Centre for Buddhist Studies. So that's all I have for you this evening. I offer that for your reflection and edification and hopefully a bit of amusement as well. And if anybody has any questions or comments or any good jokes, then please, we would love to hear them. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, they will be printing it as a hard copy. That'll be coming out soon. I'm not exactly sure of the date, but yes, yeah. And it'll also, I think it may also be published through the Buddhist Publication Society as well. Yeah. There may or may not be. Yeah. I hope so. You can ask. Yeah. Yeah. Go and ask. Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else? Questions? We have. Oh, yeah, go on. Repeat it again. When is spiritual speculation? What do you mean exactly? What do you mean by spiritual speculation? Can you be more specific? I'm not entirely sure what you're getting at.
Craving sort of understanding and spiritual, you know, healthy. What's healthy and what's unhealthy?
I think I understand what you mean. You're sort of pointing out that, of course, mind, and that point is very important, that our minds long for understanding. Yeah? And so with this search for the Dhamma, we're always searching to try to understand things, right? And part of that search, sometimes then we look to the suttas and the scriptures and things like that, but we always have that caveat that, well, it can never really be 100%, can it, right? I mean, the understanding we have inside ourselves, that can be certain, right? You've experienced suffering. You're certain about that. No one can ever convince you otherwise. On the other hand, the kind of knowledge which you get from the suttas or something like that is always a bit uncertain, a bit unreliable, subject to interpretation and so on, and we can become very attached to that. And I think that's very true. And I think that we can quite subtly and without noticing it, fall into these kinds of traps, right? Where we grasp onto the surface of things, and we forget about what was really true and really meaningful. Yeah, and I think that's actually very important. And that's not something which it always happens. Right? It doesn't matter what it is. It happens with meditation, right? It happens with anything, but. So there's no magic bullet to overcoming that, but I think we need to keep on just being real and keep on questioning, keep on challenging yourself in new ways, and be aware that these things will always happen. There's a wonderful story which I hear sometimes, and this is a fake Buddhist story. Okay, this is not authentic; it's not found in any sutta, and I've got no idea where it comes from. But anyway, the Buddha and Mara were watching a man walk along the road, and then the man stopped for a minute and bent down and he picked up a piece of the truth. And then Mara smiled. You know, Mara is the Buddha's deceiver, right? So he's like Satan or something like that. Anyway, so the Buddha says to him, Mara, why did you smile? He just found a piece of the truth. And Mara said, ah, just give him a moment, he'll make a doctrine out of it. Yeah. So you always have to be on the alert all the time. Yes?
Is that working? Hello. Yeah, so the Buddha, Jesus, Socrates, Shakespeare, none of them wrote down themselves.
Interesting, huh?
That has always fascinated me, and it's rather than a question, I suppose it's a request, Bhante, for a reflection on that.
Yeah, but did Shakespeare not write stuff down?
It was his troupe, and, well, it's contested, but certainly he didn't appear to have gone to any great lengths that we know of to, right. You know, provide a written sort of, you know, record of his plays. There were scripts that they used were basically cobbled together for the actors, that had been scripts that the actors had used, and then later there was a folio, which is really, they don't really know.
Okay. Probably
people from his troupe acting troupe who'd put it together, yeah.
Yeah, and not just them, but many others. Mahavira, the founder of the Jains, Muhammad, the great Upanishadic sages, Yajnavalkya and others. And, of course, all of the older generation of pre-Socratic philosophers as well. Yes, for those of us who write books, this is a sobering sobering reality. What can I say?
I mean, the Buddha would have been aware that his tradition was going to be carried on orally. Reframe it in another sense.
Not entirely sure of that, but anyway.
Well... Okay, so how would he have thought his teachings were going to be passed on through the ages? Did he think that was important? Did he consider the oral tradition sufficient? Or did he envisage that, well, at some point these will be committed to writing and that's an issue?
No, I don't think that actually the sense that I get from the suttas, the suttas aren't explicit, but generally speaking, they seem to think in a fairly short time frame in the future. Yeah, often you find this aspiration, may the true Dhamma last long, yeah? and these kinds of things. I don't think that anybody was thinking in terms of 2,500 years. I think people were thinking maybe in terms of a few hundred years, realistically.
Just to go back to the original sort of request about just a reflection on the fact that so many of these teachings were passed down
orally
for at least some time before they were committed to writing.
Yeah. Well, I mean that's a whole kind of another area. This is one of the areas where the skeptics will again attack the authenticity of the text by saying that they weren't written down. Of course, with the fallacy of that being that there's precisely zero evidence that a written manuscript tradition is any more reliable than an oral one, right? And we know for a fact that oral traditions can be extremely reliable, and that the memorized texts can be passed down in a highly precise way for a very long period of time. And the best example of that, of course, is the Rig Veda in the Indian tradition, which is passed down in oral tradition with an unbelievable fidelity for at least a couple of thousand years. Why they didn't write stuff down, I'm not entirely sure. I don't think that in ancient India, I don't think that the technology existed for writing down large things. I think maybe they used it for bills of lading and maybe personal letters and stuff like that. But I think they probably just used like leaves and things. They didn't have the actual full palm leaf manuscripts until later, I don't think. I think there's certainly something to that is also a part of the authenticity thing, isn't it? There's something to the immediacy. I mean, as a musician, I think of someone like Robert Johnson, right? It's the same kind of thing, right? Oh, those blues guys, you know, they just had a guitar and they just sang, right? This is just it. Get your guitar, learn some songs. Step number three, sell your soul to the devil, then you're set, okay? And, you know, once or twice in their lives, somebody will catch them with a microphone and get a couple of scratchy songs down, you know? And that thus is the legend born, right? And that's the most authentic thing. Not kind of spending hours and months in the studio perfecting every last hi-hat sound or whatever. So I think there's something about the immediacy and the reality of that direct transmission. The Buddha's there with his students and it's in that moment. Yeah. And he's obviously was very, very responsive and very, very contextual. He was talking to these people at this time. Eddie doesn't need a mic.
Ajahn Sudhato, yeah. This is a follow-up to the previous question asked by the person, okay? We should not forget that the Buddha, he taught for 45 years. 45 years is a very long time. You know. He did not go around, you know, like converting people, but teaching, you know, okay? And most of it is through oral transmission, you know? It's just like a 45 years. It's become a way of life for the people. So it's just like, you know, like, all right, you see what I mean? So it's like, Do you get... Sorry? Yeah, it's like 45 years is a long time, you know, to teach, okay? Yeah, so it's just like it gets into people's head, so it comes down, okay? And later on, it was produced in books. And also, I believe that there was some of the suttas written in leaves, too, in leaves.
Much later, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I have another question here from the internet. Hello, Fred from UK. Okay. So Fred from the UK, you say it's wrong to rely on authority. Buddhism is like a science. Maybe you said something along those lines, but I was mainly just to clarify that claim is kind of one of the standard claims of modernist Buddhism that kind of developed around the early to mid 20th century. So it's a very common claim. In some respects, I do think Buddhism is very like a science. But anyway, let's go on. Fred is a research scientist. After visiting a Theravada monastery, he found that Buddhism and science are worlds apart. Firstly, Buddhists have the faith that the Buddha got it right, to use a phrase Ajahn Brahmali often uses. Okay, fair enough. In science, there is never such a faith in the infallibility of earlier scientists. Indeed, such faith would be the end of scientific progress. So, yes, I'd agree with that. I think that there is a sense in which, in a spiritual sense, we believe that the Buddha found the answer. And within science, of course, there's always a sense that knowledge is imperfect and it's always progressing to the future. So in that respect, yes, I'd agree that Buddhism and science are different. Secondly, many customs, like the fact that monks sit higher up than laymen, sends the implicit message that monks have a superiority of some sort. Well, duh. In science... things are much more egalitarian and thus discourage genuine questioning of their teachings. I think there's probably a confusion there. In science, things are much more egalitarian and probably means thus encourage genuine questionings of their teachings. Can you comment? Well, yes, I think that's a thing. And that very aspect that, let's say, monks are sitting higher and various other kinds of things. Much of that, not necessarily all of that, but much of that is also a product of later Buddhism and different customs and so on, which is quite different from what you find in the suttas. And in the suttas, things are, relatively speaking, much more egalitarian than you find in contemporary forms of Buddhism. For example, in Buddhism in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, and most other places, you find that there are a lot of titles that monks have, right? And people often ask me this, are you an Ajahn yet? Or, these kinds of things, as if the Ajahn is some kind of title that you're given. But people get these titles. Ajahn Brahm was given a title of being a Jao Kun and these kinds of things. So you establish this kind of hierarchy. And all of this kind of thing is completely absent from the early Buddhist texts, okay? So everything was kind of much flatter. And so that a lot of what you're seeing in those kinds of customs are actually things which are found as part of a later tradition. They're not found in early Buddhism. And I would argue that they're things, part of the things that we can use in the early Buddhist texts to question and critique what's going on with the contemporary traditions. And I don't think... I think that a lot of those things are quite unhealthy and not very good for Buddhism. Okay, so I would agree that sitting the monks up on a high seat gives some sort of implicit message of in superiority. And personally, I don't really like it. When I built a monastery, and I didn't have any of those things in the monastery. You can go and see the floor is flat. We didn't have a stage like this, and that was quite deliberate. What the Buddha did say in the suttas and what is that somebody who's teaching the Dhamma should sit in a higher place, all right? And that's out of respect for the Dhamma. It's not out of respect for the person, right? This is quite different, okay? What that means is that if I'm here now, I'm teaching the Dhamma, so I sit on a higher seat, but when your turn comes to teach the Dhamma, then you sit on the higher seat and I sit on the lower seat. It's not something which is personally based, right? And that's a very, very different way of looking at it. So this is one of those areas where we can use the teachings of early Buddhism to critique what's happening in the later traditions. So I would agree with that. However, I would add the caveat that I don't honestly think it's all that different from what happens in science. Okay? To some degree, yes, in science you encourages that kind of questioning and things like that. But I mean, really, you don't have like the tenured professor or something whose word, is regarded as being far more authoritative than that of the young student or the person who's got the Nobel Prize. Suddenly his words treated exactly the same as me who knows nothing about it. I mean, really? I don't really think so. I think that every sphere and every sort of cultural context, there are ways of establishing this kind of hierarchy and levels of authority and so on. Now, it's not to say it's handled the same way in each of those contexts, but I think that it's always there. So to me, it's more of a difference maybe of degree rather than an absolute difference. But I do think that come back to the Buddhist context, I think it's very important that we question this, and that sense of superiority and so on really needs to be challenged. And I think a lot of it really needs to be just thrown out, personally. Anyway, so hopefully that's answered your questions. Fred from the UK.